Hello, this is David Rovics, and you are listening to the liberated airwaves of 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Keith Brownio. Today, Margot Patterson is joined by Annette Lance Simmons, Executive Director of the Community Mediation Center, to talk about the programs, training, and services. CMC provides conflict resolution for schools, buses, churches, neighborhoods, and families in the Kansas City area. Stay tuned for the 420 drug war news and our calendar at the end of the show. And now here's Margot and Annette.
Hello, Annette. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Could we start off by you telling us a little bit about how the Community Mediation Center got started and the range of problems the CMC handles?
Sure. About 13 years ago, a woman named Diane Kaiser came to the Kansas City area after having started and run a community mediation center in Iowa. And along with Sandy Gamay, who also had been trained in conflict resolution and mediation, they started the Community Mediation Center. So just the two of them working as volunteers to get it off the ground, and they started knocking on doors and finding out where the services were needed. And little by little, it grew to the center that we have today. There are 8 employees, not all full-time, but with people with different kinds of expertise. We have 2 school specialists. We have domestic mediators. We have neighborhood mediators, trainers. We do several types of training. So it has really developed, and we're kind of the best kept secret in Kansas City, but people are finding out about us and learning how our services can help.
What's the biggest obstacle to getting people to sit down and try to resolve their problems with each other?
Well, it's interesting that you say that. The biggest challenge in mediation is actually getting people to come to the table. Once they do, and once they engage in the respectful process that we set up for them, usually people are able to work things out and come to some kind of conclusion, some kind of plan to move forward. But when we talk to people on the phone and invite them, usually one party will call and then we'll call and invite the other party to mediation, they'll say, that won't work.
I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about what mediation involves, what it's really about.
Sure. If you look at the court system, when, say, a neighbor has a problem with another neighbor and it involves money and they decide to go to small claims court, they might get a lawyer to talk for them. They might go before a judge who would make a decision about who was right and who was wrong, who had to pay, and so forth. Mediation is the conflict party's chance to work things out for themselves, to not have somebody else tell them what to do. So we bring people together with 2 mediators in the room. It's a completely different kind of conversation than they've ever had before. Sometimes it's gotten very escalated with yelling and threats and so forth. So when there are mediators in the room and we set this process, they tell their story. First one while the other listens, and then the other one gets to talk while the other party listens. So when they hear each other, they see the human face of the other, and they're able to have empathy, understanding, to clear up misunderstandings, and then they co-create a plan moving forward. They're going to stay neighbors. Nobody wants to move, but they have to learn how to live together and to work together, and so they get to create that themselves.
When I spoke to you a few days ago, you said, we see miracles every day in people who never thought they could work with other people to solve a problem. Let me ask you about that. What are some of the miracles you've seen?
A recent situation, two parties who were completely at odds. One was a homeowner wanting to sell the property to someone who was renting. And it had just gotten all convoluted and out of control, and they were not speaking to each other. So they came to mediation, both of them saying, this is never going to work. They were so angry. And by the end of the 2 hours, one of the parties who was the most adamant that it was not going to work handed the mediator a $50 donation for the Community Mediation Center because he was so pleased with the outcome and having the opportunity to work it out. You know, a situation that could have just gone on and gotten worse, and those are the situations that escalate to violence sometimes. They worked it out, and they were happy. They were shaking hands. Sometimes we see parties come in completely at odds, and by the time they leave, they're making playdates for their kids. So it's just a really amazing process.
You mentioned that the center offers interpersonal conflict resolution training to, I think, anyone who's interested in it.
Yes.
Well, that does sound like it would be useful for just about anybody and everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I was fascinated by your mention that people have different conflict resolution styles.
Mm.
Could you say more about that?
Sure. Because of our family of origin, because of our personalities, we come through life with different ways of handling things. So I may be a person who likes to really think through things before I talk. And in a conflict situation, I'll become even more that way. I'll become more withdrawn and need to go away and think for a little bit before I say anything. You might be a person who wears their emotions on their sleeve. And if something happens, you are right out there with it, and you are wanting to deal with it and get it taken care of. So if we are in a conflict together, those different styles will bump up against each other. I won't recognize your need to get it out on the table right away. You might not recognize my need to go away and have space from it. So there's a conflict there. There's, you know, we our styles are kind of fighting with each other before we even get to what we were upset about.
I think you mentioned that there are four different conflict resolution styles.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say what the four are?
Well, the instrument that we use is the Gilmore-Fraley style profile. And they identify achieving, directing, analyzing, preserving, accommodating, harmonizing, and the fourth one is eluding me. There's a fourth one. But the titles kind of give you a little bit of a sense for the characteristics of them.
Area police departments, schools, courts have referred people to the Community Mediation Center. What are your staff most commonly asked to help out with?
You know, every week is different.
Mm-hmm.
Some weeks we will have four different schools call us and say we need a mediation tomorrow between a group of six girls. And so we'll, you know, rush around and find mediators to go do that. Sometimes we will get a couple calls a week from a police officer who has a neighborhood situation that he or she has not been able to nudge in a good direction. And so we'll call us to try and get involved there. So there really is not a typical week ever. it just really varies a lot.
In terms of schools, are there different challenges dealing with younger people than with older people?
Different challenges. The older we get, the more set in our ways we are. When we train younger kids, first, second, third grade, with a process called Talk It Out, they get it. They use it. You know, they're not protecting themselves from it. It's actually easier to work with younger kids. Up into the teenage years, there's more posturing that goes on, you know, more peer pressure to look cool and so forth. So, it gets harder and harder to have people unlearn the defenses that they have learned throughout their lives and to adopt a new process, you know, a new, more peaceful way of dealing with conflict.
You've got two staff members at Southwest High School 2 days a week working with students.
Mm-hmm.
How did that particular arrangement come about?
At one point, we had a federal grant that allowed us to do a lot of work in schools. When that ended and the government kind of shifted how they doled out money, we kept our fingers in several schools when we were able to, when we had the funding to do that. Dr. Richardson at Southwest High School has been instrumental in having us become part of the culture there. So we have found funding to do that. The schools don't have funding to do it. But we've been able to have a couple people there, and then we have a couple of volunteers that go there also with them. So there's sometimes four people in the school. The kids are getting used to them. The kids are coming. They're self-referring to those people. I need a mediation, or this is going to get out of hand. They hear a lot. The teachers and the counselors will refer people. Students to our mediators. They'll do some training. There's some anger management work going on there. So it has made a shift. It has made a difference. The students see the teachers and the administration wanting to listen to them, and kids don't get listened to. When anybody is able to tell their story and they see someone is listening, they see someone wants to help them work through that, it just really makes a difference on how you feel about being in your school or being in your family or anywhere, really.
What are the most common conflicts that come up in high schools?
He said, she said. You know, somebody made a comment and somebody passed it on to somebody else, and you know, with the electronics, it can be all over a class, all over a grade, you know, in no time. And most of the time, that there's a misunderstanding somewhere along the way, and so instead of going to the other person that you heard said something about you, they you know, bring other people into it, and it just grows exponentially. So we give them a chance to sit face to face and say, did you do this? Well, this is what I said. Really? Oh, well, that's not what I heard. And so they get to clear it up.
How does anger management work? I mean, how do you go about training people to control their temper?
By having them get to know themselves first. What are their triggers? What are the body signs? When I'm getting worked up, my face feels hot. And so I recognize that as a sign that things are escalating. And by recognizing that, I can control it and make a different choice. Rather than say something out of anger, I can take some deep breaths and feel that shift in my body. As I'm getting oxygen, then I can think better. So it's just getting people to recognize those signs and then make a different choice. And we help them, you know, write out what different choice might you make if this situation happens. So they think ahead of time, before they're in the situation, they think about what might be more helpful. And then when that happens, they have that skill and they have that, they remember, you know, the different choice that they can make.
I know one of the things that the Community Mediation Center has sponsored or handled are victim offender dialogues. Can you tell us a little bit about how that works?
Well, there again, the court system is not known for making sure everyone has the information that they need, making sure that everyone's needs are met. There's not opportunities for engagement, for people sitting across from each other and working things out. So a victim-offender dialogue puts the victim of a crime across from the offender. With the help of skilled mediators, they begin to unravel what was going on at the time of the harm happened. So when someone offends, there's a story there. It's not just that one incident that it just happened. There's a whole backstory there. When someone is victimized, there's a story there. Here's how it affected me. Here's how it affected my family. Here's what the harm caused in my life. So there again, they're seeing the human face of that harm. The offender is seeing the consequences of the harm that they did. And that is that's a powerful situation when people are talking to each other as human beings instead of the, I don't know, more impersonal process of the court.
And are there ever any risks to such dialogue between victims and offenders?
Risks as far as it getting out of hand? We do pretty thorough intake before those processes. Some victim-offender dialogue takes 6 months to set up, and you meet with the offender, you meet with the victim, you talk them through it so that they know what to expect. We would not put a victim and offender together if the offender is not sorry about what they did, because that could re-victimize the victim. So it's a very careful process and has to be handled just right for it to be successful.
I understand that in the past, the center was mainly dealing with juvenile offenders, but that recently you've begun dealing with adult offenders. Mm-hmm. Could you say a little bit more about that, how that happened?
Sure. Abby Mueller, the neighborhood prosecutor for the East Zone, and Evelyn McLean is in the prosecutor's office. They, through someone else, Rose McLarney, who's on our board of directors, and Eric West, who came to them with an idea for a restorative justice process. Abby came to CMC to see about us training neighborhood people to serve on the accountability boards. So we did that in February. We trained 50 people. It was an awesome experience to have community people that ready, willing, and excited about doing a restorative justice process like this. So we are managing the boards. We're calling the people together. We're facilitating the boards for now until the community is able to do that for themselves. But we've had three boards so far. They've been shoplifting offenses. There have been several other offenses, but they've had great results, and the board members that were trained have been thrilled about the outcome of that. Can't believe how powerful and impactful it is for all concerned. They sit in those boards. There's maybe five community board members and then the offender. And I believe the victim has been involved a couple of times, but they talk about a plan to make it right. They talk about the services that the offender might need, that the victim might need to regain wholeness after this offense. So they co-create a plan to make it as right as possible.
And what are some of the things victims can do to make it right in the eyes of their in the eyes of the person they've offended? What are some of the things offenders can do?
Mm-hmm. A lot of times they come up with community service type things. For a large store, one of the restitution pieces was that person would come and break down boxes at the back of the store. It can be any number of things having to do with the victim specifically, or just something that gives back to the community. So the idea is you're not separating that offender from his or her community, you're helping them become better members of the community. So you don't separate them, you draw them back in. With accountability, they connect with somebody on the board for follow-up to make sure that they're doing what they need to do. So they're getting support to be better people instead of being pushed away.
You mentioned the term restorative justice processes. Are there different types of restorative justice processes, and what is usually meant by that term, restorative justice?
Restorative justice very generally means that the parties involved in harm are brought together to create a plan to move forward. So it involves the victim, it involves the offender, and it involves the community, which is impacted when harm happens. What was the harm? What are the needs created from the harm? Whose obligations are they to fill those needs? And then the fourth piece is engagement. So coming face to face to work it out. So that's just a very general, and yet there's many different kinds of restorative justice processes, but they involve those same things.
I'm curious, how did you get involved in this work, and what is the satisfaction you found with it?
Well, to get very personal, I was raised in the Mennonite Church, which is historically a peace church. I'm a middle child, so I've been mediating my whole life. About 10 years ago, I was kind of complaining to a good friend of mine that I was in the middle of somebody's, you know, argument and didn't like it. And she said, "What if that's what you're supposed to do with your life?" So I went, "Huh, never thought of that." So I went and found mediation training. I found a graduate program at Eastern Mennonite University that I went every summer for 5 weeks and was involved in this fabulous graduate program, and have just found my life's calling, really. Every day I get to do something that feeds me and helps other people, and it's just really what I'm supposed to be doing.
What are the most difficult conflicts to mediate?
I would say family situations, because of the complexity of those relationships. There's never just one thing going on. I do quite a few domestic situations that involve visitation and things with children, and those are pretty complicated.
And with domestic mediation, is that mainly couples having problems, or is it just as often couples with their children?
A lot of times, either never married parents or parents that are separating. But we do get situations. A couple weeks ago, I had a mother and a grown daughter who was living with her mother, and they weren't getting along. And so they came in to set some ground rules about the household so that they could continue living together.
And do you think these skills that your staff teach are transferable to other and larger conflicts? Like, do you find yourself listening to news about, you know, gridlock in our nation's capital and mm-hmm. thinking, oh, these people could really do with some?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, from two people to a group of 100 people, the concepts transfer. And, conflict is not something that you fix in one setting. Conflict is kind of cyclical, and you look at building relationships and doing it better the next time.
Annette Lance Simmons, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
And now the 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
There is on a mission to change the public's perception about the people who smoke marijuana, and it's taking its crusade for patients' rights to the airwaves.
I get muscle spasms real bad.
I was hit by a drunk driver.
I'm 11 years and eighth survivor.
This bold, fully paid-for TV commercial is the first of its kind in the entire country. The producer says these are real people who use cannabis to help deal with a variety of serious ailments. You never see a marijuana plant or hear a blatant reference to the drug. And the dispensary's director says that was done on purpose.
I'm not looking at getting people high. I'm looking at getting people well.
Lynette Davies got involved with medicinal marijuana 5 years ago. She became an advocate after the medications her teenage daughter took for a rare bone disease were too much for her to handle.
I've been a patient of Canacare for 5 or 6 years now.
Her daughter is the first person who appears in this ad.
It was so awful that she dropped on the floor one day, and she went into spasms on the floor, and she begged me. She was 15 years old, and she begged me to let her die. She begged me to let her die.
Davies is a conservative Christian, and she wants to make her position clear. She does not support Proposition 19, which would legalize marijuana. She wants the state to have strict rules and regulations on the use of what she says God's nature has created. Not everyone is buying that religious sales pitch. Randy Thomason is with MarijuanaHarmsFamilies.com.
What's next? Medical cocaine? Medical heroin?
Thomason says a survey in San Diego found 98% of people who said they use pot for medicinal purposes just wanted to get stoned. And he says research has proven it's a gateway drug to cocaine and meth. He says no matter how you push it, marijuana is extremely harmful. And this ad is purely dangerous propaganda.
This is going to harm people if they get used to it. And this ad, sadly, is mainstreaming pot. It's not good and it shouldn't be run.
Our station is the first TV station to air it, and the interim general manager defends it. He says in part, under careful supervision of a physician, people have said they benefited from the appropriately prescribed dosage of medicinal marijuana. And he also says the CannaCare ad is no different than this one.
These things are for real. So is Excedrin migraine.
And what we're trying to do is not have these patients be ashamed or be ridiculed or feel humiliated, because they're already going through so much. We just want them to know that if this herb helps them, we're here to help you.
It's funny, isn't it, how the one drug that's never killed anybody is just so damn scary. It's creepy. This is Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
This is the Jaws of Justice radio calendar for March 25th, 2013. 24th District Representative Judy Morgan is hosting a town hall meeting. This will be April 4th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. in Canova Hall at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. Judy will have information about Medicare expansion in Missouri. Refreshments will be served. The Kansas City chapter of the Missouri Association for Social Welfare will have their first Friday gathering April 5th, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, Kansas City, Missouri. The discussion will be about current and critical legislation in the Missouri legislature. The guests will be Senate Minority Leader Jolie Justice and Joanna Sebelian of Harvesters and Janet Mott Oxford, Executive Director of the Missouri Association for Welfare. Leslie's Legacy of Love Memorial Blood Drive and Health Fair will be held Saturday, April 6th, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Swope Health Services, Building C, 3801 Blue Ridge, Kansas City, Missouri. You can book an appointment at www.savealifenow.org or call Usler at 816-536-5942 or email usr87@hotmail.com. The Skilled Traders Outreach event scheduled at last Saturday at Swope Park Shelter, House Number 1, will be postponed. Stay tuned to Jaws of Justice Radio for information on the rescheduled event. My name is Keith Brownhill. You can find these items and more on Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page or our page at KKFI website, www.kkfi.org.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. If you have comments or questions, check out the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, www.kkfi.org. You can join the Jaws of Justice Radio group by emailing us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. My name is Jeff Humfeld, and we thank our engineer today, Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz.